to begin now with in this round robin session, and I'm looking forward to it with great anticipation. We have so many competent people here among you as seminar participants, and we're very appreciative for that because it raises the whole level of our discussions. And we had set aside 1 hour so that we could each have 6 participants, as I mentioned. Each side, I hate to use that word, but each of our presenters has found 2 persons who are willing to speak or would like to be sponsored by them. And so we'll take the time and we'll slice off a couple of minutes for the introduction. And we'll give each side, IBRI will have 2 speakers, each having, let's say, 13 minutes. And then ICR would have 2 speakers, each with 13 minutes as well. Okay, so Herb, these will be 13-minute sessions. And before we begin, I'd like Dr. Newman to come and just introduce his first presenter on the IBRI defense or position.
All righty. Our first speaker will be Dr. John Bloom. Dr. Bloom is doing about 50 things at the moment. He's working on a doctorate in ancient Near Eastern studies at Dropsy University. He's computer consultant for the Annenberg Research Center, which is a postdoctoral Jewish studies program in Philadelphia. He is teaching a physics lab at Ursinus College. He is maintenance engineer for our church. Dr. Bloom has a BA in physics from Grinnell College and a doctorate in biophysics from Cornell University, and a Master of Arts in Religion and a Master of Divinity from Biblical Theological Seminary, and a Master of Science in Ancient Near Eastern Studies from Dropsy University. Dr. Bloom.
One of the well-educated janitors of America here. How many PhDs do you know that work on sump pumps and things like that? I really appreciate the tone of the seminars that we've been having here, especially the desire to evaluate models rather than people, rather than attacking people and that kind of thing, to be approaching, trying to analyze the data to develop the best model for what's going on. And to keep in mind that the real enemy that we're dealing with is the ones outside the room here, the ones, the Carl Sagans, the Asimovs, those type of people that are using the data of science to justify atheism. And I don't think that's valid at all. And that's what we should be speaking to, is, you know, keeping that in mind. I just want to give a couple of quick responses here to a couple of things that Dr. Gish brought up that weren't touched on in earlier responses. One was his objection to the hypothetical observer in Genesis 1. This is the model that Dr. Newman uses in his book on the origin of the earth, that it's portraying Genesis 1 in the model of a human observer following the formation of the earth through the collapse of the gas cloud to form the solar system. He objected to that, but I think we see the hypothetical observer being used very commonly in the scripture. For example, in the case of the woman at the well, the only people that are directly involved there are Jesus and the woman. And yet the story is told to us from the vantage point of a hypothetical observer, a third person, us, being there to hear the conversation between the two people. Very common event in literature and narrative to use hypothetical observers. A hypothetical observer in the forming earth to show us how it was forming from our perspective, I think is a reasonable thing. Another point I would bring up is the second law of thermodynamics. That is a very tricky issue to use. I think it's a very valid argument when we're looking at the universe as a whole, that the energy sources in the universe are running down. That implies that there must have been a beginning at one time. You don't have an infinite source of energy for an infinite period of time in the structure of the universe as we know it. There had to have been a creator that started it going. Dr. Gish's arguments on that point are very valid and very true. However, when we apply that second law of thermodynamics to a small system, such as the formation of a star, such as the formation of life, this is from the secular side, the second law of thermodynamics doesn't apply because it applies to what they call a closed system. a system which no outside energy can come into it. The whole universe is a closed system as far as we know. But a star forming or life forming on a planet is an open system because there's an outside source of energy coming in from the sun that can go against the natural tendency of things to degrade. So to speak as a secular physicist to the second law of thermodynamics, that's what they would say. And I feel, you know, we should qualify that argument that it applies to the universe as a whole, but we should be careful when we're using it against evolution, per se, at the star, stellar, or life level. I guess what I'd like to spend the rest of my time on here is a great caution that I see. Coming from a science background and going into theological studies and that kind of a thing, I see a great danger in men wanting to oversimplify God. And this, I think, has led to a great deal of problems. And I worry that that's what we might be trying to do in the appeal to the plain reading of the text argument. Are we trying to oversimplify God to make him into a model that we can understand well, and yet that's not actually the way he is? In some of the examples that Dr. Phillips and Dr. Newman brought up, we saw how the plain reading does not always work well when we're trying to construct models in theology. Jehovah's Witnesses will use plain reading to deny the deity of Christ. And yet, you know, how do you have a God-man together in some of our theological constructs? In trying to work history and reconcile some of the chronologies in the Old Testament with what we know from outside history. Again, the simplest reading of the biblical text, leads to a mess. And this was recognized for several hundred years by conservative scholars, till finally Thiele came along and was able to integrate the data into a model that even liberals recognize as a reasonable treatment of the chronologies in Kings and Chronicles. So again, the plain reading can be a dangerous oversimplification to be making. For example, when God says, one day to me is like 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is one day, and says, my ways aren't your ways, and your ways aren't mine. For us to be able to say dogmatically that Genesis 1 must imply 24-hour days strikes me as perhaps pushing what God's intending to say there in the attempt to make, again, the plain reading. I'd agree with, I'm going to mispronounce your name, Jim, that I can remember. All right. I agree with Jim that we really should be using the Bible as a basis for our biases. We really need to do that and not be accepting secular models and that kind of a thing. But we have to watch out for what our traditional readings that we're using to influence our biases rather than the actual data that's in the text itself. So again, it can look very spiritual, and I would appeal to it too, to say we've got to build our biases off the biblical material. But I think we have to watch out for what I would call a traditional reading that we're comfortable with because that's the way people, Christians, have been dealing with it for an extended period of time. But that might not be what is actually there. There might have been a change from how it was originally understood by people to how we have understood it, and now we're going back to correct it. But yet we're changing what would be the traditional reading in doing that. So when I come across a model of the scriptures that says that so much of the natural revelation that's out there is fictitious in a way, it's showing us apparent age, or I have to explain it, its existence only on the basis of miracle, makes me a little bit nervous, because I see God using means very, very often. For example, we think of the Exodus and the splitting of the Red Sea, and we think that's an incredible miracle that God has done. Yet when you read the text closely, God used means to split the Red Sea. He had this great wind come to blow the water apart for the children of Israel to go through. So even when we're looking at things that are miraculous that God has done, he can still be using a physical means to carry them out. So if we see evidence in geology and in rocks and things like that that shows us what are, in the end result, miraculous things, life being here, then can we discount any of the means that God might have used to do that? Does that necessarily mean that when God spoke, it instantly happened with the snap of the fingers? Or did that command that he gave start a process that might not have naturally taken place, but nevertheless involved some means to give the final result that he wanted? So I'm not wanting to deny miracles or the ability of God to do miracles or the ability of God to have created the earth in six 24-hour days. I'm not denying God's power to have done that. But I say, when we look at his natural revelation, do we find there things that show us that he used means to create it, and those means involved periods of time? So that would be the approach I would want to take. I would want to bring up the one point that Dr. Newman did raise, is that we want to make sure that when we're presenting God's truth, that we're not raising stumbling blocks that aren't really there. The only offense that should really be there to the unbeliever is the offense of the cross. And if they're offended by a model that we've made that's erroneous, then I think we're in the position of Job's friends. Job's friends came to Job when he was suffering and said, "Job, you know, you've got a problem. God is punishing you because you've sinned. Now, you're not willing to admit that, but we know that you've done it because you're suffering." They had an overly simplified model of what human suffering implied. It implied God's judgment. But yet, when God finally confronts Job, he then confronts his three friends and said, "You guys blew it. You had too simple a model of what was going on." And those men then had to come to Job and ask his forgiveness in order for them, for that to work out. Job offered sacrifices on their behalf at the end. So again, we have to watch out for oversimplified models that sound spiritual, because they're simple and they work well in general, but there might be exceptions, and they could mislead people and put up a false offense to them for turning to the gospel. And whose fault is that? Is that God's fault or is that our fault? And being in the position of having a brother who, when he found out I had become a believer, his first question to me was, he's a physicist, "Do you really think the earth is 4,000 years old? I know that that's a major issue in the secular community. And if I look at the data and I say, if I put together the data from Scripture and I can see that that fits with the natural revelation that God has given, to give me a model that where the two are consistent, then that's showing me God's glory in an even greater way. And I don't have to have a stumbling block, be putting a stumbling block in front of people." So with that, I've probably not shot my 13 minutes.
One minute short.
1 minute short. That's all right. I'll give more opportunity for someone else to speak.
Thank you, Dr. Bloom. Dr. Gish will introduce your speaker.
Yes. I think I'll call first upon Dr. Robert Getty. Dr. Getty has his bachelor's degree, master's degree, and PhD in chemistry from the University of Florida. And then I understand you worked 6.5 years for DuPont. And then he served for 26.5 years as a missionary in Korea. That's where I first met Dr. Getty. So my second visit to Korea, I was in the city of Daejeon to give a lecture there at the local university, and had the pleasure of getting acquainted then with Bob Getty and his wife Emily. Certainly a pleasure to have Dr. Getty with us. And Dr. Getty, we'll give you 13 minutes or a fraction thereof.
You can tell I'm not an engineer. Also, you can tell that I was in South Korea for 26.5 years, and that's where I got my drawl. I think it was Bob Newman talking about you feel like you had a 20-ton load of coal dumped on you here. but I appreciate the opportunity to be here and to hear a number of comments, suggestions, because while I am a young earth creationist, I've been interested in trying to understand where the old earth position comes from and try to understand it better. I must admit that I still don't understand all that I'd like to understand. But I feel, talking about the miracles that we were just listening to, I think one of the things that's concerned me, I know in my own personal experience, I was on the mission field 10 years before I became a born-again believer, and that's another whole story. But before that, I was pretty much of a theistic evolutionist, but after becoming a believer and not having problems with the miracles, then it was an easy step, I feel, for me to come into an understanding of a recent creation. Now, I admit that God, being who He is and all-powerful, can work however He wants to. But I find some examples, particularly from the chemistry background, the water into wine, with all our natural understanding, this should take many years. You've got to plant the grapevine, you've got to have the grapes mature, you've got to ferment them, so forth. But yet, it was just one instant, it went from water to alcohol. God could do that just as easily. We read that Christ is the Creator, could go just as easily with some of the steps in creation. Of course, too, there are other examples. All the miracles in the New Testament are instantaneous ones, except the two-step process, the blind man who saw men as trees, and then the second step, it was cleared up. And we find the changing of our bodies to the resurrection body will be in the flash, in the twinkling of an eye. There's no opportunity for a long period of time there. There are other examples. I think that one of the assumptions that I have difficulty with in the progressive creationist position, as well as in some of these others that deal with an old earth, is that the assumption seems to me, or the bias, and we're all biased, is I don't think anybody denies that point, is the whole idea that the rates that we observe today are constant. The uniformitarian idea that I know there's a lot of discussion about Barry Setterfield's work on the speed of light, but we don't know for sure that the speed of light has always been constant, or that this is an assumption. We can't prove it. We can't prove that it hasn't been. We can't prove that it has been. And at this point in time, things can always change. There are other assumptions that the rates are the same, and this affects our conclusions based on the data that we observe. I feel, too, that in an effort to reconcile what we read in the Scriptures with what we see in science, that this reconciliation does not really offer an answer to an atheistic evolutionist, because he rejects God, period. It doesn't matter how God operates, whether he operates rapidly, slowly, or whatever. That my own feeling is that the real change comes about as the Holy Spirit works in the person's life. Just as you become a believer, I think it's the same way as you become a creationist. That it's not our amassing of a lot of information. I started out thinking that if I could dump enough on somebody that I'd drown them and they'd become a creationist, you know, this sort of thing. I found that, well, that just doesn't work. Now, a couple of comments that have been mentioned, and last Saturday, a week ago, about this time, we were about halfway up to 5,000 feet out of Grand Canyon, climbing out that 9 miles and 5,000 feet. Glad I'm able to stand up and talk to you today. but some of the things that impressed us as we were down on the Colorado River is, the massive amount of work that went on there. We find that there is not a unanimity of opinion on how the Grand Canyon was formed, either among creationists or atheistic evolutionary geologists. The Kaibab uplift is supposedly 65 million years old by evolutionary geology calculation. The Colorado River, only 4 million. Yet we find a tremendous cutting down there, a very rapid evidence that seems, and there are many that are subscribing to the idea, perhaps of an earthen dam that broke and a dammed up lake that went through the Kaibab uplift and washed out the canyon. Of course, Steve Austin from ICR has done a lot of comparison between Mount St. Helens, which Dr. Gish has already mentioned, and the Grand Canyon. There are problems, too, with the layers. You have some interbedding or intertwining of some of these layers. There's some of them that are real neat, you know, one right on top of the other like a layer cake. There are others where you have the interbedding that you cannot easily see how you would have progressive laying down by whatever theory. There are other times when you find a mixture of fossils. I understand that in, I think it's the Kaibab limestone, the top layer, there you find so-called simple organisms, sponges and this sort of thing, which should not be up at the top, should be down at the bottom. You have wrong order strata in many places. In the Grand Canyon, of course, there's strata that are completely missing out of this so-called progression. Other places, you have the order, the older layer above the younger layer and this sort of thing. There's some explanations where you can explain this by overthrusting, where you should have the breccia, the broken rock in between the layers. Some places you find that. Other places you don't. They're conformably one on top of the other. But yet, there's an explanation needed for that wrong order. Specimen Ridge was one of the things that was cited. Steve Austin's work at Mount St. Helens has indicated that a lot of these floating forests, or what you call them, the upright logs, not all of them end up horizontally in the log mat. Many of them are becoming upright in Spirit Lake. The roots have become saturated and are down. The roots are just a root ball, not all of the peripheral roots. Some of them are settling down at different levels in the sediment down there. As the sediment comes in, as some of the remains of the trees come down, and to all practical purposes, it looks like successive forests there. You look at Specimen Ridge, you find many areas where you don't have the topsoil or soil underneath. There's no root system. You don't have the roots breaking up what you would expect to find in soil. So that there is evidence, I think now, currently, and recent finds, really, in the last several years, that perhaps these forests in Specimen Ridge could have come in over a period of time as the trees were settling out. We find many rapid formations, such as the Scablades flood in Washington, where a tremendous amount of material was washed out. There are other areas, the Johnstone flood here in Pennsylvania that I always read about, had no idea that we'd be here in Pennsylvania eventually. But things happen very rapidly in those type of flood incidences. We were told last week when we were down on the Colorado River, rather uncomforting, about the problems with the Glen Canyon Dam and how it almost broke through, I think in 83, and it would have wiped out everything down the river, and there we were downriver. But they said that, of course, if this had given way, then we would have really seen just a small example of what a flood could do. And, of course, with Mount St. Helens, we did see many things happening in a very short time with a tremendous unleashing of power. In some cases, some 600 feet of strata had been laid down over a 24-hour period. And Steve Austin said that as he observed this, he'd have never believed it, even being a young Earth creationist. He wouldn't have believed it until he saw it, actually observed it, very minute layers of strata in there, I guess almost hundreds of different layers in this that had been laid down in a very short time. And we're talking about something that was really relatively small in terms of what happened there at Mount St. Helens. Another thing is that in the evaporites, many of the beds that would supposedly have been formed by evaporation of seawater should have marine forms in there. They don't. They seem to be relatively pure. And these could be formed by differential precipitation of different solutions coming in and thereby getting large amounts of relatively pure material. These, I think, will conclude. How much time do I have left? 2 minutes. Okay, we're doing fine. We're picking up time.
All right, on the Ivry side, our next speaker is only involved in four activities, actually. Dr. John Studenroth is pastor of the Penn Ridge Community Church. He is working on his doctorate in ancient Near Eastern studies at Dropsy University. And he teaches biology at Pinebrook Junior College. Dr. Studenroth has his bachelor's and master's degree from the University of Maine, a bachelor's in botany, and a master's in plant pathology, his doctorate from Cornell in plant pathology. He is a master of divinity and master of arts in biblical studies from Biblical Theological Seminary, and he is working on the doctorate in ancient Near Eastern studies at Dropsy University.
I'm the other janitor, Bible Fellowship Church.
Let me figure out how this works here.
Microphone ends up behind my tie. Is that a problem? Let me try it this way. Okay. I want to try to use up these 10 minutes these guys are accumulating here. Yeah, okay. I'm a botanist, not a physicist or an engineer either. Okay, is this picking up okay? I would like to share with you some thoughts, probably more from a pastoral perspective rather than my botanical, plant pathological perspective, or perhaps it would be a mixture of the two. But I'm presently a pastor of a small independent church, and I think even more significant to the issues expressed this weekend, I was an assistant pastor at a local Bible-believing Protestant church, fundamental church in Ithaca, New York, for 3 or 4 years, where we dealt with college students and tried to reach them for the Lord. And I will say, by God's grace, reached a fair number for the Lord and had the joy of seeing them become Christians. I see one of my children right here, Mike Fish. And through Mike Fish, I have grandchildren and great-grandchildren in the Lord because this guy is a soul winner. I'm going to talk to this guy afterwards. The Lord has really blessed and used him. Well, in witnessing to university students, you do come up with a lot of objections. They're being trained in the sciences, many of them. Those are the types I tended to deal with. And just like John Bloom said about his own brother, one of the first things they're going to ask you is, do you really think the earth is only 10,000 years old? If you say, yep, they're just going to write you off. Now, if it's true that the earth is only 10,000 years old, I should say yes and let them write me off. But I, having looked at the evidence, am not persuaded that I need to erect that stumbling block. And so that was not a stumbling block. And what I'd like to suggest here this afternoon is that in saying that the earth is old, not only do I believe we're faithful to the inerrant word of God, but I believe in no way are we capitulating to macroevolutionists, and I want to carry it one step further. I think we will watch the macroevolutionists paint themselves into a corner. And there's the joy of our position. I am not a geologist, but when I was at Cornell, I had some good Christian friends in my local church who were. I'm not a physicist, but I had friends like John Bloom who are. I'm not even a paleontologist. I'm a plant pathologist. We study sick African violets and things like that. So my training really doesn't help me. I'm out in the cornfield tracking down aphids and studying viruses, and I have to admit, my training did not equip me for these questions, but I had the joy of rubbing shoulders with men in the proper fields. And what impressed me with Dr. Newman and Dr. Bloom and Dr. Phillips and a few other men who aren't here today is that they all come at the same answer. One guy is looking at it geologically. Dr. Newman's looking at it astronomically. And there's real agreement among several channels of science. They're coming out with a 20 billion year, a 15 to 20 billion year old universe, and they're coming out with a 4.5 billion year old Earth. And there's a kind of agreement on different avenues of evidence. And that strikes me as significant. When you get several channels telling you the same thing, it's harder to just brush it aside and say you're misreading your data. And I think Dr. Newman pointed that out, that overlap of different lines of evidence. Well, Linnaeus was a believer. He believed in the fixity of species and thought the Bible taught it. This is a century before Darwin. Linnaeus changed his mind as he did his binomial nomenclature and carefully studied genera and species. He said, no, there's a flexibility here in the creation. God did not create every species that I see today. There's the ability for some flexibility here. I think Linnaeus was correct. Linnaeus never lost his faith in the scriptures. As far as we can tell, he was a believer to the end. I'd like to point out some other interesting people who are not directly in our camp, perhaps, but they see what I'm talking about when I say that if we accept an old earth, the evidence moves in our favor. One of these is Wickramasinghe, who's been mentioned, Fred Hoyle's right-hand man, a Buddhist. I think he was an atheistic Buddhist for a while, if you can have such a thing. But Wickramasinghe, as I understand it, came to America to help the Christians in some of these court battles. I don't know if it was Arkansas, Louisiana, or both, but he flew, didn't he, over here?
I mean,
just Arkansas. He's an old earther like us, and he would not in any way bend on this age of the earth. He would say it's 4.5 billion years old. But he saw so keenly the other aspects of the young earth argument that were correct that he was willing to come over and help battle in the court case on their behalf. I was impressed with that. I'm impressed with Robert Jastrow. He's coming at it as an astronomer, and he wrote that book, which was very popular for a while, God and the Astronomers, in which he takes to task his fellow astronomers because they don't want to accept the Big Bang. You see, it's not just the young earth people who have trouble with the Big Bang. It's a lot of astronomers. Secular, unbelieving astronomers are troubled by the Big Bang. Fred Hoyle is troubled by the Big Bang. It conflicts with his steady-state view of the universe, and that's why we can get a lot of juicy quotes from Fred Hoyle against the Big Bang. Big Bang speaks of God, a universe that had a beginning, an explosion, and is stretching out into space, and we can still hear the echo of that explosion. It is creepy to the unbeliever. They don't like it, because it does speak of the possibility of a moment of creation, a beginning, and they really don't want that. They would rather, in many cases, have an eternal universe that's always sort of been around, maybe flexing in and out, but not this distinct beginning, before which what was there before that. Jastrow concludes his book, God and the Astronomers. Some of you may have read it. Right at the end, he says, finally, the astronomers are climbing this high mountain, and just as they're ready to pull themselves over the last crag of the mountain, they finally have this knowledge of how the universe began. They find a band of theologians been sitting there the whole time. Jastrow is an agnostic, and he will admit to that. He says, I don't know if there's a God or not, but what I find happening among my fellow astronomers is an intellectual dishonesty, a shying away from the Big Bang because it speaks theistically. And then he takes them to task. What's the matter with you guys? Are you afraid of evidence? This type of thing is in our favor, and I don't believe we should be running from the Big Bang. And I want to give you an example now that does touch a little bit on my botanical background. Let's suppose the Earth is 4.5 billion years old, and they're right that they're now finding fossils in the Precambrian rocks. At first, this is very troubling to Christians. You say, good grief. If you're going to find fossils of bacteria 3.5 billion years old, 2 billion years old, some of these very well-preserved microfossils, you're giving the evolutionists enough time now. From that, they go to more complex eukaryotic organisms, and then they work up to multicellular, and finally we get all the plants and animals we see today. You're opening the floodgates for macroevolution. Let me put it this way. The earliest fossils that we can find are virtually identical to the blue-green algae, otherwise known as cyanobacteria, that we have today. Drop all my papers here. These little creatures, these little blue-green algae, cyanobacteria, are prokaryotic. They are simple, relatively speaking, compared to other forms of life, but they're exceedingly complex compared to non-life. And they're doing photosynthesis. You take the simplest little blue-green algae, single-celled critter, maybe in a colony, and it's got thylakoid membranes in it. It's doing the same thing that a higher plant does in its chloroplasts. And I wish I had an hour and a bunch of overheads here to show you. I teach general biology at Pinebrook Junior College, and I always warn my students there's going to be two hard chapters, respiration and photosynthesis, and they're right in the middle of the semester. It's like climbing a mountain, and then we slide down the other side. And if you can just get past chapters 7 and 8 in your textbook, you're home free. Photosynthesis is so incredibly complex. You go finer and finer and finer in your resolution. You have this green leaf, and you get into one cell, and you get into the chloroplast, and then there's thylakoid membranes inside the chloroplast, and then there's a proton pump inside the inner thylakoid membrane, and there's chemiosmosis going on, and there's photosystems embedded in the membrane, all these proteins, an electron transport system, and the kids are pulling their hair out saying, stop, stop, stop. And I just tell them, if you go on to graduate school, it'll be worse than this. You'll have to memorize all these things. It is. It's very complex. And I'd like to summarize it like this. In the year 1945, a man named Rabinowitz wrote a 3-volume treatise on photosynthesis. He concluded, I believe, in 1956. They claim it's the last time that any one man on the face of the earth could comprehensively understand photosynthesis and write a treatise on all that we know about it. Since that time, knowledge has just mushroomed and exploded and mushroomed and continues today, so that in any technical library, in any university, you will find journals dedicated to photosynthesis. Entire journals called Photosynthetica, and coming from Finland to Denmark, as well as America, Canada, Russia, all these guys cranking out articles in photosynthesis, the latest breakthrough. If you wanted to study photosynthesis today, or your son or daughter wants to study it, and they would like to major in plant physiology and then spend their lives studying photosynthesis, that's too broad a field. You have to subdivide. You have to major in one tiny aspect of photosynthesis. So at Cornell, we had a Dr. Andre Jagendorf, who's the world-renowned expert on the proton pump of chemiosmosis happening in one little thylakoid membrane of a chloroplast, and every year he's graduating PhDs in this area. Where are all these guys going? Every one of them is becoming an expert, training more graduate students. And there's enough information in that thylakoid membrane of that chloroplast to keep them all putting bread on the table. You say, whoa, man. And the blue-green algae, 3.5 billion years ago, were doing it. And we're still unraveling. And I say, these guys are painting themselves in a corner. Let them have their Precambrian rocks. Let them have their microfossils. They're painting themselves into a corner. The Earth has barely cooled down enough to support life. And boom, we have cyanobacteria doing photosynthesis the same way it's being done today. And we can't even keep up with it. We cannot understand it all. It's so huge, so complex. God, only God could have done that. Do I have a few minutes?
Yep.
Phew. Let me move real quick to a second point. Proverbs, 2 minutes?
Two and a half.
Proverbs 8. I'd like to suggest that God not only knew what he was doing in his creation, but that he enjoyed it. A philosophical question that sometimes comes up is if the earth is indeed 4.5 billion years old and you have all these extinct plants, and believe me, as a paleobotanist, I've looked at this sometimes, there are major groups of plants we don't have anymore. You could say the flood just killed them all selectively and certain things survive. But as we look at the geological column, we find whole families that are virtually wiped out. All kinds of ferns that we don't have, seed ferns, lycopods, bizarre plants buried in the coal beds of the Carboniferous period, and they don't have them anymore. And in place, we have a whole bunch of angiosperms that were not fossilized. So the Lord really reworked his landscape a few times. There's a few major extinctions. Dinosaurs are the animal side of this picture. Really bizarre creatures. What is God doing if Adam never saw them and nobody ever saw them? What a waste of time and energy for God to create all these things, remove them, and we don't get to see them. Proverbs 8:22, where wisdom is personified, and I will not ascribe this to any particular member of the Trinity, but I think it's an attribute of all three members of the Trinity. Wisdom personified in Proverbs 8:22 says, "The Lord possessed me at the beginning of his way, before his works of old. From everlasting I was established from the beginning, from the earliest times of the earth. When there were no depths, I was brought forth. When there were no springs abounding with water, before the mountains were settled, before the hills I was brought forth. While he had not yet made the earth and the fields, nor the first dust of the world, when he established the heavens, I was there. When he inscribed a circle in the face of the deep, when he made firm the skies above, when the springs of the deep became fixed, when he set for the sea its boundary, so that the water should not transgress his command, when he marked out the foundations of the earth, then I was beside him as a master workman. And I was daily his delight." The New International Version says, "I was the craftsman at his side. I was filled with delight day after day," yom yom in Hebrew, "rejoicing always in his presence, rejoicing in his whole world, and delighting in mankind." I see a lot of time going by here, by the way. I see the master craftsman delighting himself in all that God is doing at the creation. The New American Standard has a footnote, rejoicing, footnote, playing, P-L-A-Y-I-N-G, playing. In what sense is wisdom playing? Is that not beneath God's dignity to play? I went and looked up the Hebrew, sahak. What's going on in this verb? The meanings that you get in a Hebrew lexicon is to smile, to laugh, to play, to joke, to entertain, to amuse, to act clumsy, to make somebody else laugh, to cause people to smile, to laugh. It's a party word. It's a jolly good time sort of word. And God says, "I had a wonderful time." And I would like to suggest that the Trinity enjoyed their creation, knowing that only the last stage was for us. That those dinosaurs, which so capture the imagination of children, as we now discover the bones, put them in our museums, make plastic models, also capture the imagination of the Creator, who has a sense of imagination, sense of beauty, sense of humor. And in all due respect, I can believe that one member of the Trinity may have said to another, "Let's see how big an animal we can make with a brain the size of a walnut that still works." Okay.
Our next participant is Dr. Wayne Frere. Has his PhD from some little college on the east. I think it's called Rutgers University in zoology. And Wayne, have you been there at King's College ever since? Or Well, maybe Wayne is like Dr. Morris. Dr. Morris said when he went to college, they were teaching that the earth was 2 billion years old. Now they're saying it's 4.5 billion years old. Maybe that says something about how long ago it was he went to college. So maybe that was about to say with Dr. Frere. It's a pleasure to have Dr. Frere with us with his PhD in zoology. Been teaching zoology and biology there at King's College for a few years now. Glad to have him. Thank you. Things I forgot to mention. Dr. Getty is now with the Associates for Biblical Research, and Dr. Frere is now the president of the Creation Research Society.
Thank you. I'm a specialist on turtles, and I was going to bring some of them along today, but I resisted the temptation. We were talking about bias. I was just thinking of what John said at the lunch table today. He hoped he wasn't biased to think that his bias was the best of all biases. I guess I have my bias as well. This week I had a letter in the CRS mail. It was a very unusual letter. It was from a man who's in music. And he had some background in science, but he's in music. And he said, I think we're on the wrong track. Talking so much about science, he said, what we need are some good creationist songs and hymns. He said, Martin Luther's hymns did more for the Reformation than his theology did. Now, it's something to think about. It kind of knocked me off base for a little while, but I enjoyed thinking about this. And we get all these technical questions coming in. Tell me all you know about the flood and how big was the ark and how many animals and why is the Bible inspired, and what about science? And so many things come in that are technical, and so this was a kind of a comic relief. And maybe it's something we should think about. Maybe think of this song that some of the students at our college are singing. It has to do with Abraham Lincoln. I said to my wife, would you like to sing this song just a couple minutes ago? And she said, you must be kidding. Well, I would be kidding for me to sing it too. But it has to do with Abraham Lincoln. He was asked, if he believed that God was on his side or was God on the other side. And he said, what concerns me is if I am on God's side. He didn't know about the other aspect of it. And I think that's the important thing for every one of us to realize that we are on God's side. And the alternatives to believing in something other than God in the Bible are far worse than dealing with the problems that we have with our particular biases and our commitments to God and to His Word. I was reading the two humanist manifestos recently. One came out in 1933 and the other one 40 years later in 1973. And there is a difference between these because the second one is more realistic in dealing with the way people are. The first humanist manifesto was much more idealistic about what we are going to do. The second one recognized the problems with human nature much more realistically. So I could see this coming around to a position that's maybe a little bit closer to what we would hold. Now, I'd like to point out a couple issues that I think are important for our considerations. Young Earth, Old Earth situation. This issue of Young Earth, Old Earth is interesting that we can discuss this here today. I mean, 40 years ago, this probably wouldn't have been done. There's been an upsurge in the last 40 years in the belief in a Young Earth position. And I've seen a number of my friends go to this position. But 40 years ago, the Old Earth position was a prominent one. I would feel more comfortable about an old earth position if I could see it among older scholars. Now, when I brought this up, people say, well, that wasn't an issue 200, 300, 400 or more years ago, and this is why they weren't discussing this. Then some say that Augustine held the position that could be consistent with an old earth position, and I'm not convinced by this. I think the days when Augustine said there were days of God, I don't think he probably was thinking about an older physician. So I'd feel more comfortable if somehow we could get some evidence that went back, and maybe somebody will like to deal with that. Another problem we face is Genesis chapter 4. I was speaking some years ago happened to be at Cornell, for a campus crusade. And I can remember this Chinese fellow sitting there and looking at me and saying, "What's the main problem with believing in evolution? Why shouldn't I believe in evolution?" Well, from my standpoint, it's the creation of man. I think if we're going to focus on something, that's it. And that's, of course, great concern to all of us. And Genesis chapter 4 has something very pertinent in there if we're going to take this Bible literally. In the beginning of the chapter is Adam and Eve, and she's giving birth to Cain. And Abel is keeping flocks and working the soil. Now, these activities are Neolithic. They're within the last 10,000 years or slightly longer than that, the keeping of flocks and working the soil, going back a few thousand years. Over in the latter part of this chapter, we have metal. Also, that's recent, back 10,000 years or so. Maybe the farming could go back a little earlier, but still, these are recent. And if we're going to accept this as historical, we have to deal frontally with this issue. And it certainly looks to me like this is referring to something relatively recent. These were the recent descendants of Adam and Eve. So I find it very difficult, personally, to push the creation of this creation back beyond some thousands of years, not into the hundreds of thousands or millions of years. And I think we're seeing, as evidence accumulates, that Homo sapiens is more distinct than we had thought previously. I was just reading some literature this week, and people are trying to separate the Neanderthals from Homo sapiens. And one of the authorities was saying, I think we need to get them farther from a modern man than previously has been thought. So I think that this is one of the big problems with an older position, at least for mankind. Now, coming to some more practical issues that where the rubber hits the road for all of us, I'll mention Lincoln again. They asked Lincoln how long a man's legs should be, and his answer was that they should be long enough to reach the ground. Now, we have to get about our Christian living. And I think this is of utmost importance to all of us. I mean, we're here and we're living with some problems. And the point I want to make is, number one, I have several points under the practical, it's possible to live with a problem. Maybe I should say problems, put it in the plural. I was saved when I was in the United States Navy, the tail end of the Second World War. I came out and started at the university, and I found myself getting into science. And I was enjoying biology so much that I started to come up with a lot of questions. So I transferred and went to a Christian college from which I graduated. And I went there expecting I was going to get all the answers to my questions, but I didn't. And it was a frustrating time for me until I realized, and it was with great relief, that it is possible to live with a problem. And I can remember the load that went off me when I discovered this as a junior in college, that, hey, I don't have to get an answer for everything. 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 12. For now we see but a poor reflection. Then we shall see face to face. Now I know in part. Then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known. This is a very practical verse, and I think it cuts through a lot of the problems that we wrestle with when we realize that things are in God's hand. Now I'd like to follow up, secondly, on something that has come up before. The number of the speakers, John Bloom, particularly stressed this, and it's Christian witnessing. John Montgomery, the very strong apologist in our country, has pointed out that for Christian living, we can stress that we don't have to have an answer to all of the origins of questions. And he outlines the three positions that Bible-believing Christians have held. The young earth position, the old earth, which he's calling threshold creation, and the theistic evolution. He would restrict theistic evolution to a narrow band of people. In fact, he says, if you're Christian witnessing, let me back up a little bit on this. If somebody has a barrier to the cross of Christ, and they feel that you must hold a particular position in order to believe the Bible, we can point out to them that there are a variety of positions that are held by Bible-believing Christians, and that it's not necessary to hold any one of them. And thus we can pull down that barrier and get the person to the cross of Christ. And that should be our goal, to get people to the cross of Jesus Christ. If any barriers are up there because they feel that the Bible has to take a certain position. Now, I have my own inclinations. I feel on the basis of the Bible that I incline toward the young earth position. I don't have a hard-nosed view on this, but this is my strong inclination at this stage on the basis of what I see in the Bible, and I think there are some big questions here, and I'm still living with some of these. But for Christian witnessing, we can say there are Bible-believing Christians who hold to the young earth position, and that's usually where the rub comes in. Or there are some who hold to the old earth position, or some that hold to theistic evolution. Now, Montgomery says the theistic evolution position he would only bring up for those who can see through a keyhole with both eyes at the same time. But somebody asks him if he believes it, but he says, well, he makes room for that position. Today we've pretty well excluded this as an option for Christians, and I would go along with that. I think we have the abrupt appearance position, and all of the speakers would agree with that, that in accordance with what it says in Genesis chapter 1, there are kinds, basic kinds, and we can call this the abrupt appearance of position. Now, I think we should stress this abrupt appearance of position, and that we also can point out the difference between origin science and operation science, that there is a difference there, Genesis 1 and the basic kinds in nature. Now I'd like to just say a little about the trial, the Little Rock, Arkansas trial. I was there. Dwayne Gish was there. There may have been others that were there as well. Some of us tried to stress the point at this trial that we do have the abrupt appearance model with which to view nature. This is presented in Denton's book. It would be consistent, I think, with what Denton is saying. That book is out there on the table, and I want to recommend this as probably the strongest anti-evolution book that's been written. 1 minute? Okay. Now, what they were saying was that this is all religion. Creation is all religion. But we can separate this into the philosophical, God did it or it happened by chance, or the abrupt appearance or macroevolution. I think we have to distinguish this. And it's perfectly appropriate in our public schools to tell students that we do have these two positions. I think we need to make this clear in education. Also, I think teachers should be pointing out to their students that there are many scientists who believe that God has done the creating, and it's not necessary to hold a position that nature did this, where we have a self-sustaining universe, in order to be a scientist. We can believe that in the beginning, God created.
Thank you very much. The three of the qualities of a miracle are, number one, that it's God did it. Number two, that it's a unique solution. And number three, that the timing is perfect. Had God parted the waters of the Red Sea one day late, consequences might have been different.
You'll notice the miracles are still happening because the timing is still perfect. We are precisely on schedule with our conference. We're supposed to be at 4:30 to 4:45. And I think this break will take the cake. We'll meet back at 4:45 for our closing session.